Hey, everybody, welcome to another Bald Move Prestige. This time we're talking about The Social Network that recently celebrated its 10th birthday. It's directed by David Fincher with a crackling, I'm going to call it crackling, screenplay by Aaron Sorkin. It's based on The Accidental Billionaires by Ben Mezrich, who you might have heard us talk about his book, his first book. I think it's probably most famous book, Bringing Down the House, the inside story of how six MIT students took Vegas for millions. It stars Jesse Eisenberg, Andrew Garfield, Justin Timberlake, Armie Hammer, two Armie Hammers for the price of one, Max Minghella, Rashida Jones, and features very early work by Rooney Mara and Dakota Johnson, and features the first ever soundtrack collaboration by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, which I believe you're the guy that is the expert at this stuff. They took home Oscar Gold for Jim.
Yeah, apparently.
It's a historical fact. It was filmed in and around various Boston prep schools, standing in for Harvard, and LA, standing in for Silicon Valley. Jim, The Social Network. What's your history of this film, and have you seen it before? And if so, what's your relationship to it now?
We went and saw it years ago, back when it first came out. So a decade now, and I hadn't seen it since. I think I saw it that once, and then, you know, flipped it on yesterday to check it out again for this podcast. The way I remember it coming out of that movie the first time was very much a feeling of like, man, I want to get out there and I want to create something, you know, I want to build the empire. Right. Second time I get that sense, but it's lessened by the events that happen sort of after this movie and the the complicated, let's say, post movie history that Facebook has with our society. And just like, you know, as I look more at the guy Mark Zuckerberg as portrayed in this film, and I don't want to say that's the real Mark Zuckerberg because I don't know, I've never met him, he comes across as more of an asshole and less of an inspiration, but I don't know, that's just how I felt the first and second times. What about you?
Everybody wants to build an empire until they're confronted with the horrors of imperialism.
Sure.
I thought we talked about this a little bit before podcast, that this movie was kind of a big influence in Bald Move, not from like corporate practices and structure, but just like, yeah, like this movie came out 6 months into the Bald Move experiment before we'd ever found success with like television and movies, back when we were just doing a couple guys talking about stuff. In fact, one of our very first pieces of merch was inspired. I don't know. It was inspired by an after this film discussion at Steak and Shake, which is a hallowed tradition for us. Damn, it feels good to be a rancor.
Yeah.
That T-shirt, like one of the very first pieces of Bald Move merch. Do you even still have one? Do you have a Rancor shirt still?
I think I still have one. Yeah,
I think I might have one in the back of my closet. But it like, yeah, like it, like, I think you and I were still living together this period, and it ushered in a period of whiteboarding and trying to think of like what we could do. How could we replicate some of the success here? Cause you did, you want to go out and build something. You want to move fast. You want to break things. And like you, I have come to a different way of looking at this movie now. I read one thing, I think it was from Slash Film, where they talked about this being a supervillain origin story. And that does feel pretty right on. Unfortunately, a lot of the stuff that they really it's probably, we probably need to wait to discuss this, because like there's this narrative about like, was this film fair to Mark Zuckerberg? And I remember that was a big thing 10 years ago. Like, well, was he this big of an asshole? You know, he's actually married to the woman that he was dating during this movie. And it wasn't, they made kind of like, they fabricated and maybe trumped up a little of the misogyny, his personal misogyny. And I know that's like what a lot, like, I think both Sorkin and Fincher kind of had some light apology for like, hey, sorry for, you know, maybe doing you dirty in this film, Mark. But, you know, it's a story. We're trying to tell a story here. And interestingly, like Mark Zuckerberg himself is like taken personal exception about that aspect of the film. But he's never once been like, actually, and also I hate the way that they portrayed me as backstabbing my friends and betraying business confidants and like welching on deals and trying to screw people over because I don't know. Is that the factual part of the movie?
I mean, a lot of this is a matter of record in the courts. There's a lot of information you can go on here. Including live journal posts that are in fact real. You know, I went and I looked and read through some of these things. They're word for word, what you see in the movie. And yeah, I mean, it's, I definitely think Sorkin took some liberties with the story to make it more interesting, to make it more emotionally engaging for people. And that's where I start to say, okay, well, I don't know how I feel about Mark the guy, but I do know how I feel about the events as they transpired in the film, which are pretty much based on real life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. where do you want to go from here? I mean, I'll also say that I think this is just an amazing film. This is one of the best scripts I've ever seen. David Fincher, just like, I remember a lot of the chatter about this movie was like, oh, they're going to make a movie about Facebook. How fucking boring could that possibly be? Yeah. It's riveting. This film is a 2-hour movie that dares you to peel your eyeballs off of it. And there's so many, like Sorkin just, I don't probably didn't stumble into, he's pretty good at what he does, but like the frame of him using these court depositions as kind of the backbone of the movie, these dueling three stories. You know, like which one is real or the elements of them all, you know, and then like there's, you know, there's three stories. So there's potentially three protagonists. But like also is Zuckerberg a protagonist? Is the Winklevoss twins protagonist? Is I forget his buddy that he ultimately screwed. Oh, Sean Eduardo. Parker. No, he's not a Eduardo. Is Eduardo a hero? I don't know, because as you said, there's reams of court documentation and you could probably make a case for either of those possibilities. But
I'm curious where your sympathies lie in this, because it's a very mixed bag when it comes to who I feel screwed, who and who I feel got the short end of the stick and didn't get justice here. Because like there's a point in the movie where I go, well, these people should just call it quits, like, and go their separate ways, right? Like, if Eduardo and Mark don't agree on the fundamental nature of this business, then they should just, you know, split up and go do their own things, right? He should go Eduardo should go do his internship, Mark should work on Facebook, Sean Parker, whatever. And you get the sense that, like, if that had happened, they might still be friends, right? Like, they're
possibly.
Yeah, like somewhere along the way, this was clearly doomed because the people didn't have the same vision for it. So why continue? Mm-hmm. But I don't know. There's a lot of money.
But it's wild because involved. Like if you like split like at any point other than Facebook having 1 million users and being, you know, worth $1 billion, like who is happy? Because like, you know, you know, James Garfield, Eduardo had fronted all the expenses and put all the skin in the game. Zuckerberg had most of the code, although Eduardo, they point out, had some key algorithmic contributions to make as well.
Yeah, his chess.
And he's
algorithm?
Yeah.
Which I think is just how they've always ranked chess players. I don't think that was his, like maybe he's the only one who knew about it in this group, but he didn't invent that, right?
Well, I mean, but that's the thing. It's like that's a rushing nesting doll argument that goes back to like who invented anything, who was like, you know, like
sure. Well, that's not my point. My point is like I just didn't see it as the brilliant insight that the movie was trying to tell me it was.
Well, but like, that's the thing. It's like I'm unique, also trying.
Yeah,
sure. I'm also like going off of like other research I did where it's like he kind of was the algorithm guy. And, you know, Zuckerberg was definitely the coder and, you know, did the majority of the sweat equity and all that kind of stuff. But I guess one of his weaknesses is that he didn't, you know, this guy had a library of like business algorithms and competition algorithms and all that kind of stuff that he made it took advantage of. And like I said, that's the damnable thing about like these businesses is like anytime money gets involved, like, you know, who did what for what. I mean, shit, we've had several of those incidences, not necessarily between us, but like if, with other third parties involved, in just a 10 years of a very small concern Bald Move has been operating.
Yeah.
Maybe we should, before we go on, just like for people that haven't seen the movie, like it's hard to spoil if something is based on a real event, but you know, Social Network is essentially the story of the founding of Facebook. It is fictionalized. It does seem like a lot of the personal motivations and desires of the gentleman in this movie have been kind of reframed to fit a particular narrative. But a lot of the stuff about the lawsuits and how things changed, the unlikely involvement of the founder of Napster, all that stuff does appear to be more or less correct. And you'll recognize a couple of people like Peter Thiel, you know, that has gone on to for notoriety for other reasons. Like, isn't he the one that bankrupted Gawker with Hulk Hogan as his cat's paw for outing him as a gay man? I think is how.
No idea.
But like before, you know, Silicon Valley was a big parody on, you know, HBO. It was embodied in a lot of this film. So this is a lot of early days of Silicon Valley, a lot of corporate rating, a lot of like friends backstabbing each other, screwing each other, a lot of like casual misogyny, the stuff that you kind of see is foundational to the Silicon Valley spirit is on display of this. And this movie doesn't feel, that's the other thing, is like this feels like a fairly neutral point of view movie, right? Like, it's not asking you to say Mark Zuckerberg is a cool dude, what he did was cool. It's more of just kind of like, you know, how this thing came about and it revolutionized the world. It really did. Like, you know, it's not just Facebook. There's Twitter in there and Reddit and others. But like these new forms of social media really have changed the world in many good ways and many bad ways as well.
I think the movie definitely has an opinion on Mark Zuckerberg. The movie essentially says this guy's an asshole. I think it'd be hard to not come out of this movie feeling that way.
Yeah, there's a couple scenes I want to ask about because the movie does. I don't know, maybe it's just trying to, that's an active attempt to be even handed, that they did some things performatively. But the movie feels like it's unsure of itself, how far to push that forward, because it's also gives him a lot of, you know, sympathetic stuff too. I don't know. Let's talk about the movie.
Yeah.
What do you want to start with? I had some things I want to talk about, like the scripting, and the film, the art of the film itself, and David Fincher. Maybe we could start there.
Sure.
I already talked about the, like, I thought it's particularly brilliant to use the backbone of the legal depositions, getting everybody's side of the story as the framework to kind of tell the chronology of this film. It's the one thing that keeps kind of things, you know, well, then this happened and then this happened and then this happened, because why is this happening? Why is this coming to light at the time? Well, the lawyers are asking the questions, and that's how, and you're going through, I think, three separate lawsuits in this film. First between the Winklevoss twins and their interests with Uconnect, and then his friend Eduardo as business partner.
And that's interesting because that is not in the book, right? That we said this is based off one of Ben Mezrich's books, but that structure isn't involved in the book. And in fact, the book doesn't really have an ending per se, because it's still very much up in the air what's going to happen with those. Whereas the movie, it's weird too, because the book and the movie were being written sort of simultaneously, where Sorkin was mostly done with his script before he even really sat down with Ben Mezrich and talked in depth about the book, which seems strange given that it's based on the book, and that the movie has an ending, right? Like, it says, oh, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, blah, 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 and here's the settlements, and, you know, it essentially has an ending, whereas the book didn't have an ending, wasn't even completed, and
I thought that was interesting that I saw that Sorkin said that he read, like, you know, he's looking for books to option, and he got to like page, like, this wasn't even finished, it was like 10% done, he got the third page, is like, this is the one, I want to do this.
Yeah,
I've already been doing kind of a bunch of independent research about this tech stuff, and like, yeah, this is the one. Optioned it, and then they like started writing as a parallel process with occasional phone calls where they're like, hey, what have you found out? Oh, what have you found out? It almost is like, oh, like a courtesy Like, I don't even know why. Like, I guess it's just probably a legal problem, like the Facebook itself. Like, if you just were reading scripts to option, you read this guy, it's 50% done, and you just yoinked and made a movie about it, you know, you'd be writing a $65 million check with him standing over your shoulder. He's already taken Vegas for a ride. What are you going to do, Sorkin? You're going to outsmart the Vegas guys?
There's a lot of money to go around on this movie. They had a $40 million budget and made 240 something million.
It made a lot of money for a talky kind of, you know, highfalutin Sorkin film, for sure. Yeah. For sure. I also thought there's like a lot of really neat touches. It's something Roger Ebert talked about in his review, that like it's notoriously hard to write a film about a writer, you know, because you can't just have a 2-hour movie of a guy click clacking on a keyboard. And he's like, you know, this is like another level removed, because at least with a writer, you can understand the words that he's writing. But if he's like pounding away on a Perl script, what the fuck? It's a bunch of curly Q and braces and keywords and stuff like that. And the way they were able to do like just effortlessly things like in the very beginning, he's talking about Zuckerberg's talking about his frustration at schools lacking a decentralized or centralized Facebook. Mm-hmm. And there's like a little thing where as he's writing the document, the word processor, probably the browser, flags the word Facebook as a spelling error, you know, because it doesn't exist yet. There's things called the Facebook that they have, like these are essentially, you know, yearbooks, but like fucking Netscape doesn't know about this. Google Docs doesn't know about this. It's not a thing yet. Yeah. And there's a lot of little touches like that where you don't even notice them, but it's just like kind of underpinning the idea of this guy creating something brand new that I thought was really great.
And my, you know, tech brain who understands probably 90% of what is going on here in this scene where he's like hacking all these Facebooks to get the pictures and put them up on his own site and compare them. I'm sitting there like trying to, you know, parse the avalanche of information that's coming across in this scene to make sure that I completely understand it. It's, you don't need to, right? All you need to understand is that he is hacking the school systems to download all of their pictures and put them up on this comparison site. That's it.
And hacking is a lot. You know, like he's taking advantage of.
But yeah, there are things in there that I would definitely label hacking. Like if you have to break, you know, login systems, get around login systems in order to get these pictures, that's hacking. It just doing like a wget script to pull down pictures from an open website is not.
But I thought that was the thing he didn't really get around. It's just more like some of these pages were indexed by search engines, so he knew where the pictures were and the structure was predictable and the pictures themselves weren't. Like, it's more of like the internet was so much more open than it is now.
Yeah.
Like now half the time you right click on an image to save and you can't do it because it's a WebP file or they've
jumped through a hoop.
You have to take the unprecedented step of what, hitting F12 to bring up the developer tools and you know, it's just downloading an
add-on extension that will let you do that by right-clicking and
I mean that's are we hacking when we download a YouTube file and strip the audio out of it? Like I think they do a good job of that. They also do a really good job of showing, like, Zuckerberg being this outside, I don't really know anything about Zuckerberg, like what family he came from, but they portray him as like a dude that's there at Harvard, probably because of his merit, because he's got this giant brain and he scored 1600 on his SATs and he's worked very hard. And they contrast that with like the skull and bones porcelain or whatever the fuck, the pig secret society behind Harvard. Like, I kept on waiting for there to be a good story about all the, you know, did you do any reading about some of these secret societies?
No, I haven't like, thought about them since that Joshua Jackson, the movie Skull and Bones, right?
Yeah.
It's a Fast and Furious guy.
It's like the story of how the most prestigious secret society or final club in Harvard came to be is this: a rich kid in the 1790s really hated one of his teachers that stayed in a dorm room adjacent to his, and he had a pig in his room. And every time the teacher would try to study, he would pull on the pig's ears to make it scream. And the teacher was furious and was going through a manhunt or a pig hunt to try to find the illegal pig. And to keep him from being found, they had a midnight roast of this pig that they used solely to torture the teacher, and decided it was such splendid fun that they're going to start a club that would commemorate itself to doing such mischief. And then 100 years sure. later, I don't know, Teddy Roosevelt punched a pig. And 100 years after that, the Winklevosses came sixth in Olympics. It's a long, proud tradition. Hmm. But like the way that they said this thing like, oh, yeah, this is the fraternity that that rents out a busload of women that want to fuck the next Fed chairman. And I'm like, oh, that's probably hyperbole. But no, actually, they are renting a bus full of women who are taking ecstasy and drugs and being date raped at the fraternity. I just like how they showed the contrast between Mark Zuckerberg and his losers that are in the loser groups, and they're like digitally perving on women, you know, and setting up sites to compare them to barnyard animals and whatnot. And then the high class is renting busfuls of women and drugging and alcohol and having sex with them. I thought that stuff was really like effective at setting kind of the terms of heroics and villainy throughout the movie.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't thought about that angle. I was during those scenes where they're flashing back and forth. I was more caught up in what he's doing there. And like I said, I was mystified by like, oh, what's the technology going on here? And I wasn't paying enough attention to the what's the narrative going on here.
Yeah.
And then when they started like talking about him crashing the network, that started to not make any sense to me, because I did some math. 22,000 hits in under 2 hours is like three hits a second. If your Ivy League school can't withstand three hits a second in the mid 90s, you've got a problem. Or then it's not even the mid-90s. It's the 2000s at this point. Like, what, 2003?
I think it's the late 90s. I think it's a late... Well, this came... So Mark was 26 when this movie came out, I think.
Okay.
So, yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, he would be... That would just be 5 years ago.
I mean, all these 2005 Harvard T1 connections. It's a little unbelievable. And I don't know how much of that is fictionalized. Like, oh, we got to heighten the drama here, so let's have him crash the network and get suspended or... Not suspended, but put on academic probation.
Which the double secret probation. I also like the look of this film is really amazing. I think it's trademark, you know, I don't even know what trademark Fincher means, though, in this context. It's very slick and visually exciting. And I can't say enough about the soundtrack.
Yeah.
We now know that like, you know, Reznor and Ross are a real good combo. They've written a lot of really excellent music. I mean, Ross is now just a de facto or an actual member of Nine Inch Nails.
Oh, I don't know. I haven't kept up with them for a very long time.
I think he actually joined a band like 5 years ago. So like their like professional and personal collaboration have kind of like, you know, merged together. But like this is the first time they collaborated, and there's just some amazing stuff that really sets the tone, that makes things seem cooler or more dangerous. There's a spectacular sequence of the Winklevosses flaming out, coming in second place, which, you know, no one gives a shit about. That's the whole point of it. Set to, I think it's The King on the Mountain. It's this fairly famous piece of orchestral work. But it's all like Nine Inch Nailified and grungy and digital. And it really sets up their defeat in court. It's like something that I've never really heard before. And I didn't really remember thinking so much about it the first time, but like now that I've been a lot more familiar with their collaborations, it's unmistakable, their fingerprint on the soundtrack.
Yeah, it's of the era too, where Nine Inch Nails just was kind of doing the Nine Inch Nails thing, or Trent Reznor was doing the Nine Inch Nails thing on the screen, where like a lot of those, like even the themes where he's got just like a piano going is recognizably Nine Inch Nails, like something you hear off The Fragile. And in recent years, he's gone more toward like, you know, he's always been electronica, but like that industrial kind of stuff. In recent years, he's gone more of like the Inception route with boas and stuff like that. And it has a different flavor, but this is like in that transitional period where man, you can hear the Nine Inch Nails in this for sure.
Oh yeah, the bass lines especially. There's a club scene in particular, which like I didn't have the TV set turned up all particularly loud, but it was like shaking my living room.
Yeah.
I think it was like Justin Timberlake's first meeting with him, where he's I can't remember because there's a whole bunch of epic meetings between him and Sean. Is it Parker? Is that the guy that did Napster?
It's the club scene. You know it. If you've seen the movie, you know.
Yeah. Before we move on to the next point, let's take a quick break.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers have a chance to exercise their rights under the Patreon pact we've made by voting for the next Pulp movie that Jim and I will be covering. If you're one of the elite few backers at the executive producer level, don't miss your chance to influence us. Hurry over to patreon.com/baldmove and vote in the latest movie poll before it closes on Wednesday morning.
And for all other club members, we've got an all-new episode of Lunch with Jim and Aaron this Friday afternoon. Catch the live stream at 1 p.m. to interact with us and your fellow munchers over on Patreon, or you can wait for the podcast to drop later that day.
If you want even more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun fan favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Okay, Jim, choose your own adventure. Do you want to talk about Mark Zuckerberg? Do you want to talk about the internet, Silicon Valley culture? Where do you want to choose?
Let's talk about Zuck, I guess. Let's all Zuck right. on it for a while.
Okay. What are this movie's portrayal of Zuckerberg? I'll start. He is a man with like a brain on fire. He can barely focus on anything in front of him except for the thing, whatever is consuming the majority of his focus. And he kind of follows that to the exclusion of all else. Crazy sure. exclusion.
Yeah.
Like seemingly not caring about the details of a legal proceeding that is very much the future of his company. Being flip and lipping off the people who could get him expelled from school or could get him destroyed in court. That is, I guess, a little bit bound up in Silicon Valley culture because it's all about moving fast and breaking things and not caring about the consequences. You know, like when he, and again, this is, seems like it's the fictionalized part, but like when his girlfriend breaks up with him in the beginning of the movie, that like all he thinks about is like, what can I do to make myself feel better and get even? And I don't care that, you know, this woman is a bitch. and she's wears B-cup bras, is going to be on the internet forever and ever and ever. I just care about feeling better about myself right now. And I thought that was, I kept on thinking about dead-eyed Mark Zuckerberg in front of senators and representatives being grilled on how his platform affects elections and how it destabilizes countries across the globe and how it's addictive and all this other stuff. And that's like the, you know, like this was kid stuff. It's like wrecking his personal relationships. Like he's gone on to, you know, dominate the world. And I thought that was all very interesting.
Yeah. It's fine when it's the kid stuff, but I get the sense very much that there needs to be a sequel to this movie, or that there needs to be, or this movie was made too early, maybe, or it's like a milestone movie where there are several more tales that need to be told because of how far, you know, off the rails this whole thing has gone. But yeah, he comes across as a guy who doesn't really care about the consequences of his actions. He's simply driven by the need to do things.
Do you think it's like he doesn't care about the consequences, or like sometimes I think the Silicon Valley bros just literally don't think there are such things as consequences, like beyond like me getting fucked or me fucking somebody or me getting paid and me not getting paid. The idea that like your activities, you know, competing with other people and connecting other people could, you know, destabilize governments and harm people's psychological well-being and things of that nature. I don't know that it's that, not that they care about it. It's just like it doesn't even enter their equation. Like,
yeah, it's like a target fixation kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where the thing you care about isn't going to be affected. And so nothing will be affected.
Right. You tell a 19-year-old that like what you're about to do by hooking up college students to each other and allowing them to see their personal lives and business and share information with each other is going to somehow like destabilize things in the Middle East and in the South Pacific. And it's going to have detrimental effects on the country that you live in. Like, that does, like, I think if a fortune teller was to foretell all that to Mark Zuckerberg circa 2001, he'd be like, yeah, whatever, because how could that possibly come to be?
It sounds ridiculous.
It does.
Yeah.
And I also think like that's the one question I had is like, is the idea of Facebook just doomed? Is it bad from the start? Is it something that like we just haven't figured out how to deal with as a society? Was it the idea of Facebook fine, but the second that you added, you know, Facebook famously hired psychologists to make the cycle of using the product, the application, addictive, like to stimulate people's dopamine sensors to kind of make them almost physically and psychologically dependent on the site. Is that what made it all fucko, or is the concept itself like connecting people and sharing information, is that like a bad idea?
I don't think that's a bad idea. I mean, it's something like the movie doesn't really dwell on it, but I think it makes a point that like he's just giving people something that they want anyway.
Yeah.
And he's doing that online. And I think like the ways in which it's probably bad for that whole like social feedback loop is that it takes that and one step removes it from seeing someone face to face, right? Like they make a point. There's a line in there where like, oh, he's lying to our faces. And then somebody chimes in and says, well, he never actually lied to us face to face. It was emails. And the guy's like, all right, well, he lied to our emails. Well, it's so much easier to lie to an email address than it is to lie to someone's face. Right. And I think that's where things get murky. And you can start to question, is this a bad idea? If we didn't have this option available, would some of our more, you know, in-person social interactions be healthier than they are, right? Would we have those forums in quote unquote real life as opposed to online?
Yeah, I don't, because I keep on, it seems like the closest analogy to what we got going on in social media is the society struggle with the yellow journalism. And I made this comparison a few times. But basically, you know, the concept of yellow journalism is the idea that like people believed everything that was printed in newspapers because newspapers were traditionally, you know, like in, you know, obsessed with printing the news and keeping citizenry informed. And it became, it got, you know, successively wealthy people bought the newspapers and decided, you know what, we can actually manipulate people's perception of facts by, you know, and the fact that they believe everything in the newspaper by, you know, printing lies and omissions and shaping politics that way. The thing is like I've been doing a lot of reading. I'm not exactly sure 100% how this fucking stopped. I know that there was some muckraking journalist that like exposed all this stuff, but like, why did they get traction? Because, you know, we had this period of like 100 years where we just assumed that if someone had a large platform, they got vetted somehow. Like the Village Idiot would never be able to get on CBS and interviewed with Walter Cronkite because at several different levels, they would have revealed themselves to be the Village Idiot. And they're like, well, we're not going to platform you anymore because you're ridiculous. Nowadays, all you need is like 100,000 Village Idiots across the world to think that you're good and to like you and to signal boost you. And suddenly you are in the halls of Congress. You have a television show, a news show with a budget. You're the most watched, you know, cable news thing on. And like, it seems like a very similar yellow journalism problem, but like, I'm not 100% sure how they stopped it in the first place. And like, if it was just
did, right. That's the thing. Like it's just moved to other venues. It was in radio, right. With the talk radio, the AM radio hosts, whatever, just spouting whatever shit they wanted, somehow became trusted. The television, like news programs are no longer news programs. They're essentially editorial opinion pieces. You know, disguised as news. I don't think it ever stopped. I think it's now just getting to the point where the power to be an influencer has gotten into the hands of individuals to the point where this has become such a problem and such an obvious thing that we have no idea how to crack down on it because there are no institutions anymore, right? Like the institutions want their hands off of it and just say, well, these are people acting of their own accord, not the institution doing anything.
Yeah, because like that's one of the things I've came away with my research in yellow journalism. It just seemed like the powers that be, the gatekeepers, just decided to like, OK, well, if people want to write tabloid shit, they'll write tabloid shit, but we'll have a clear demarcation. People will just learn that like, okay, there's the National Enquirer and yes, they're a newspaper and they have a wide circulation, but like they talk about Bat Boy and shit like that. It's not, right. You know, and then you got the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Economist, and they're serious outlets. And the internet has kind of like flipped over the table and all those classifications have broken down because you've got, you know, like this, like ten years ago, they were talking about, you know, places like Slate and stuff as like people in their pajamas writing news, you know, but clearly there's a difference between people that are in their pajamas in their basement writing, taking serious approach to news, and people in their basement in their pajamas, you know, trying to incite revolutions and things like I don't know, that's what I'm saying, I don't know what happened at the turn of the 20th century that like got us that be able to like detect the difference between a newspaper and a fish rag, and like we've lost that ability now, and I think it might be because there are no gatekeepers for this. There's literally not, like, you don't need money to have a YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter account. You don't.
Right.
And the downside of that, of course, now in 2021 is people are realizing that once those companies decide, you know what, we've pursued a free speech based approach because that's what sold and now it's biting us in the ass. So like we're just going to unilaterally decide what is not acceptable content. And now people are crying fair because the thing that's always been the case, the people that have the power of the press can decide who, you know, has that kind of money, can decide who can say what on what. Like they're just reasserting that, and people like had 10 years of laissez-faire and they're saying this is bullshit.
Because before you needed the money to be able to do that, right? Like you needed somebody to fund you to do a news report that would take you 3 months of research. Cause if you didn't have that, you were going to go broke trying to research it. And then where are you going to publish it? Cause you need money to print newspapers. You need money to broadcast on television. Well, it turns out you don't need anything to do this internet thing. So,
but that's the thing, is like you kind of do, because there's been so many that's one of the other key learnings of the internet nowadays, is like one or two layers behind, it's all Amazon and Google. Like, yeah, you can run a free speech alternative to Twitter, but if you're running on Amazon's, you know, cloud computing and they get wind of it and they decide they don't like it, they can just kick you off. And then what are you going to do? You're going to go to Google's farm. And if Google kicks you off, then what are you going to do? Like, you're kind of like this digital beggar. Like, I've got all this content that I want to share, but I don't have any of the platforms and sources. And only there's like three outlets in the entire universe that have the bandwidth and the functionality. Because, you know, when my first website literally ran on my desktop through my cable modem, you know, like it was so much more decentralized than it is now. Maybe that's how it's solved. The powers that be just decide to throw up the firewalls again and like, good luck hosting your Nazi rally on some underfunded box in the Pacific Rim. Like, yeah, right, you can run this box out of Singapore.
Where's the incentive for them to do that, right? Like, the incentive is going to come from regulation. The incentive would come from, the public opinion turning on them for various reasons. Because, they make their money by having the volume, right, of people posting things. So
I will say it's not a very satisfying answer to, like, how do we get ourselves out of this, that the same three companies that got us into it just decide to, like, well, they're going to unilaterally decide what is and isn't allowed on there. Like, I think they have that right, but it sure isn't. Like, it'd be better if, like, we as a people came together and, you know, supported politicians that had smart ideas on how to regulate it and all that kind of stuff. And, like, we could, but it's like, it feels very unsatisfying to, like, again, the billions of dollars that got us in this situation are just going to put their heads together and just decide. They're just going to decide it. They're going to decide what's true and what's false, and that's it. That's it.
Especially when their modus operandi here is move fast and break things, right?
Still.
Because when they're playing with, you know, like, let's use Uber or something. When they're playing with a broken taxi system where it's $1 million a medallion and nobody makes money except the people who are at the very top of that, like, that's one thing. When they're playing with democracy and moving fast and breaking things, people's real ass lives are in jeopardy here. There are big consequences for these, and that's where I sort of get to the questions about this movie, along the lines of there's something in there where they talk about, like, the adults essentially, like, taking the kids' toys away, or like, I get this vibe coming out of this movie where you see the Winklevosses and them interacting with princes and whatever at the rowing clubs, that is like the old money, that are, those are the quote unquote adults, and then you see Mark Zuckerberg and his cadre being the kids, right? And the kids have these very valuable, obviously valuable toys that they're playing with irresponsibly, and the adults are coming in and saying, you kids are going to break these things, we're going to take those toys away from you. But are they taking the toys because they're valuable toys that might get broken, or are they taking the toys because they want them for themselves because they're very valuable? Like, there's a lot of questions I have around, like, and we see this playing out right now, you know, with the free speech stuff and the censorship stuff. Like, what if that is really true? What if that, you know, people stepping in and saying, okay, well, we need to do something about this, is because the adults are trying to take the toys from the kids? And what if that is just like, this is the responsible thing to do for the good of people? You know, it's hard to tell the difference sometimes.
And who gets to decide that? The adults.
Sure.
Another thing I found so interesting, because you can go and find contemporary discussions of this movie on Reddit, because Reddit's been around for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And you can find, like, the 10-year retrospective. And what I found was interesting is there's a lot of conversations where people are like, because, again, I don't think Zuckerberg came for money. I could be wrong on that, because, you know, but like, a lot of people were saying, oh, the Winklevosses got rich, or they got money by suing Mark Zuckerberg, and then they invested that into Bitcoin, and then they became wealthy. Like, if you came away from this film thinking the Winklevosses weren't already elite and wealthy, I don't know what the fuck to tell you.
Yeah.
They've been training for, you know, rowing at an elite university, like an elite Ivy League university, since they were 15 years old. Their parents had connections that got them in an office meeting with the president of Harvard. Mm-hmm. There is some truth to what Mark Zuckerberg says in his film about he's not getting sued because he screwed them out of like business, you know, a deal. He's getting screwed because for the first time in their life, the world told them that something's not going to happen the way it was supposed to for them. And the same thing about James Garfield's character, same deal. Like people said, oh, he got rich off of fate. No, these people already, like he was another one that came from like generational wealth. But on the other hand, like, does it not matter? Can you just rob and steal from a wealthy person with impunity? I mean, there's plenty of people probably even listen to his podcast. But yes, of course. Yes, that's Robin Hood. Hello. But like, I don't know. I don't know. And again, is it up to the adults to come in the room and tell us to stop playing with the valuable toys?
Especially when the only reason they want to do that is because those toys are valuable and they want the valuable toys for themselves. Like,
yeah. Yeah. The movie has this other thesis that they establish early on with the Mara interaction with Eisenberg here. You're going to be a very successful computer person. You're going to go through life thinking that people don't like you because you're a nerd, but it's because you're an asshole.
Yeah.
Which I think is a strong through line through the movie. But then the movie undercuts itself late in the third act by having Rashida Jones come up and be like, you know what, Mark? I don't think you're an asshole. You just work really hard to make people think you are. And I remember, like, I was watching that and I was taking my notes and it kind of like hit me like a thunderbolt. Like, what the fuck is this? Mm-hmm. Was this them just trying for Mark Zuckerberg not to sue them? Or because it seems like that's maybe a right on observation about like Zuckerberg has got this chip on his shoulder and he thinks that people hate him because he's a nerd. And that's what people just don't like nerds. But honestly, you know, you fuck over your friends, you do this and that. And you refer to that as a speeding ticket, by the way, mm-hmm. like violating friendships and going back on your word and going and doing underhanded shit to cut your buddies out of, you know, what they may or may not be entitled to. Just refer to it as a speeding ticket. I don't know that that was one false note. A very few that I found in the movie. What did you make of that?
Well, I mean, crucially, she doesn't know him very well at all. Right.
Right. They just met in the deposition room. Right.
Yeah. So I think like this is sort of a false evaluation of the character as portrayed in this film. But I'm with you. I don't know why they included it, because in my mind, it doesn't do much to sympathize that character. And if they were going to try and do something, they needed someone who knew him better to come in and say, well, yeah, you're not an asshole, but you're acting like one right now. Because the rest of the movie is saying he's an asshole. There are moments where I question it, because like Eduardo occasionally jumps to conclusions about Mark's actions. And I don't think the movie ever like puts to bed the questions about like whether Mark planted the story about the chicken. Whether Mark was the guy who wanted to screw him out of his shares of Facebook, or whether it was Sean Parker like pushing and pushing on Mark to make him do it, because they clearly had some beef, right? I don't think the movie ever puts a definitive stamp on that and says this is what we think about that particular aspect and whether he's the asshole here. And so I think there is a little bit of wiggle room to think, okay, well, maybe Mark's not the bad guy that the very beginning, the Erica part of the movie makes him look like he is.
I do think after I've read everything that I've read so far, and I've seen a couple other documentaries on Facebook, and I've read quite a bit over the last few years, that it's probably true that Eduardo did not have what it took to, like, his idea of raising money by getting advertising when they had a thing that, like, we've seen this before in podcasting, right? Like the one of the reasons it took so long for podcasting advertising to take off is because all the old people you're pitching, the advertising podcast don't listen to it, you know, or something their grandkids listen to and they take that as less serious. His approach of like going hat in hand and begging people in New York to advertise on Facebook was, I think, much less successful than Mr. Napster going to a bunch of angel investors and getting $1 billion of investment capital, or 500,000 or million, however much it was. Yeah. Like, it's entirely possible that like Mark Zuckerberg. But like the thing is Mark couldn't have done it by himself either. Like, mm-hmm. he hired a whole bunch of developers underneath him And he's the kind of one that got the ball rolling. But he, in his mind, is entitled to always 51% of Facebook. Whereas the other guy who maybe didn't have quite what it took, but he was there at the beginning and he got the ball rolling. He didn't have what it took to get it all the way to greatness. He devalued, you know, the fact that, like, I don't know, like, it's probably objective fact that without Eduardo's personal investment of like, what, $20,000 into the company and buying the servers and the laptops and all that stuff, that like Facebook would just be an idea. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and he did probably end up writing it for the Winklevosses and making them rich instead of himself. So like, both things are true, but like, I think I cannot conscious any decision that at the end of the day gives Eduardo 0.03% of Facebook.
Right.
Like, for sure. That seems like a blatant betrayal of whatever friendship, brotherhood that they had.
And it's a very effective scene when they're in the deposition and the Eduardo's lawyer is reading out, you know, the shares and the dilution percentage, right? You know, Marx wasn't diluted. Sean Parker's wasn't diluted. You know, Peter Thiel's percentages, like all these investors weren't diluted. It was only Eduardo that got his shares diluted. It seems extremely personal.
Right. And that's why he ended up with 5% of Facebook, because the courts looked at that and like, well, this is clearly bullshit. You can't it's not regardless of what papers illegal. He signed. It's literally illegal to do stuff like that. There's laws against it to keep stuff like this from happening, because otherwise, why the fuck would you ever be a minority share investor? Why would you ever do that? If they can just devalue your shares at will, it's insane. So like, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of commentary I wrote, even like Lawrence Lessig was like, you know, thumping his Bible about how this is just a tax on innovation. The Winklevoss's $65 million was that it's an affront that you have to pay for this. And this other guy getting 5% was, you know, an outrage and all that. And I'm like, I don't know, because, you know, Zuckerberg got in business with this guy for 30% of the company with his eyes wide open. So like, shit, you know, getting off, paying him off 5% seems like he was still. And that's the whole point. You know, Zuck started with this guy owning 30%. He ended with this guy and then he tried to cut him down to 0.03. He ended up owning 5%. Guess who won that exchange? It's a speeding ticket, right? Yeah. It's back to being the so.
Yeah. And I get the impression, like you said something earlier where it seemed like Mark doesn't care about anything except what he's focused on, and that this he didn't even care about these trials. But that could have been, you know, a thing that brought down his company or whatever. I don't think that was ever in question. I don't think like the existence of Facebook was ever threatened by any of these lawsuits. In my mind, this was a speeding ticket. This was like, well, you just got to pay these guys and then get back to your business, because that's, you know, this is not really going to affect him. It's like, well, he's not paying attention because it doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things, right?
I wonder how much there is true because the Winklevosses had this interesting dynamic of like, oh, this isn't cricket, chum. We don't take each other to courts and we don't bandy crooked words
and
the pages of the Crimson. You know, like we like how much of that is true and how much of that bullshit cost them even more money, because it does seem like if they had come and brought the full weight of the Winklevoss legal empire against Zuck when he had $19,000 in the account, they probably would have beat his ass.
Yeah, but what do they get?
Oblivion.
Right. It's almost better for them to wait until he creates this huge thing and then come in and make the claim than to take 100% of his $19,000, right?
Well, I mean, I guess that the question is, what would the Harvard Connect have become? Would they have had the insight and skill to parlay that into, you know, multi, or were they so up their own ass that they thought, this is only for, you know, elite Ivy League people to essentially digitize the handshake and the wink that we've got going on here? I don't know, because if they'd strangled it in the crib and then gone on to make the Harvard Connect that then became Harco, that everybody's on and has 2.8 billion users, you know, like I don't fuck. Sure. That's the thing. It's like, who the fuck knows? It's all an alternate history conversation.
And the dialogue in this movie is so good. There are a couple of moments, you know, where they're bickering during the depositions, where the Winklevoss are sitting there and they're like, I can't wait to stand over your shoulder as you write me a check. And Mark's like, yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. I did all the work. Implying, like, I did all the fucking work here. You're just going to tag along. just going to ride my coattails. Yeah, the dialogue is great. And Sorkin, obviously a master of dialogue.
Yeah, and I guess Eduardo, he had ties to South America, and he always intimated that he had ties to the mafia or the I don't know what the hell, the drug people down there.
Huh.
And Zuckerberg had a not unfounded fear of getting beat up. And I guess that got transferred in the script to Winklevosses with the line, you know, when they're fuck trying to get, legal remedies. Let's just go beat him up. I'm 6'5", 220 pounds, and there's two of me.
Yeah. What a great line.
That's a great line. But apparently, yeah, all that heavy stuff was them trying to bring in the little physical fear. But I don't feel like it ever was a credible threat. So it is a sick line from the Winklevoss twins.
Mm-hmm.
They just go dumpster this nerd, but give him a couple swirlies and. Yeah, now what, you know, put that on your masthead, Zuckerberg.
Yeah, it doesn't strike me as a guy who would be intimidated by that. He'd get beat up and then he'd go right back to doing what he's doing because he's just driven by it. Right.
Probably. What did you make of the I'm the CEO bitch business cards? That was an interesting scene.
Well, they make it a point to show, at least in this movie, that the character portrayed here, Mark Zuckerberg, is driven a lot by ego. Just a ton of this drive is ego, him not wanting to look inferior to other people, him wanting to have the last word in an argument. He's got something to prove, and that drives him forward. And this I'm CEO bitch is kind of part of that. But
yeah,
but there's a sour note at the end, right? Because when he's looking at that card, his business partner here, Sean Parker, has just been arrested for giving drugs to underage kids. He's looking at that card not thinking, oh yeah, this is the life. He's looking at that card thinking, what is this going to cost me?
Yeah. Simultaneously, he screwed over his best friend, and his new business advisor just got busted in some kind of crazy ass, mm-hmm. Drug underage party. It is he fought so hard to get this, and it's what is it worth? He's lost his rosebud, yeah. But he's got these business cards that say he's a CEO bitch. And what even is that? Or, there's Silicon Valley culture, man. The gleeful performative tearing down of structure and hierarchy and what? I'm a code juggler. I'm not a, and versus this very old school, almost robber baron look at capitalism.
Yeah.
It's there's something interesting there too. But I don't know. It's cause I'm very cynical at this point. I grew up thinking all that stuff was really cool. And I wonder how many people of my age got swindled out of lots of money because they could throw the fact that they're a code monkey on their business card and everybody thought it was cool that they could go barefoot in ratty smelly t-shirts and have stacks of beer bottles on their ping pong table, but they're getting paid below market because it's cool. We got the Silicon Valley ethos going on here. It's I don't know. I had there's a couple of places in Indianapolis of all places trying to push that stuff in the late 90s, early 2000s. And I always felt like it was a scam. It's you guys are working for peanuts, but you get to code in a beanbag chair.
Mm-hmm.
Holy shit. I'll go to work and automate spreadsheets and play bean and work 40 hours a week and play video games in my beanbag chair. I feel like I'm beating your guys' ass, but I don't know. I guess if they strike the right thing rich and get that startup thing going.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a gambling mentality to it. I don't think some of the younger generations of Wall Street people are not too different from the Silicon Valley kind of ethos.
Yeah. What do you think of the performances in this? Because I'm kind of up and down on Eisenhorn. That's his name.
Eisenberg, Jesse Eisenberg. Yeah.
Eisenberg, thank you. Eisenhorn is, I think,
you're
a
up and down
on
him?
Character.
In this movie or in his career?
No, in his career overall. Okay. He's had some stuff I've really liked. He's had some stuff I'm kind of ambivalent about. He does kind of plays a certain, part, a certain character. I think he is pretty amazing in here.
Yes.
And James Garfield is a standout.
Yeah.
I couldn't he effortlessly plays this kind of like, you know, beta party boy. But like when he's really getting fucked over by his buddy in the deposition room, I felt that like the betrayal, the idea that like Zuckerberg is like going all these low blows at him. And I thought he really connected to the material in a way that impressed me.
That scene where, you know, he realizes that he's getting screwed over, right? He got called out to California just to get screwed out of his shares.
Right. Right.
You know, and he storms into the work area there, the open office, and nearly decks Sean Parker. I think that's a fantastic scene. And James Garfield is amazing in this. It, just as Jesse Eisenberg, it's an understated character. Like Mark Zuckerberg doesn't have the passion and the fire that, you know, James Garfield is allowed to show in Eduardo, but he's just as good.
Do you, well, I want to raise another figure, Justin Timberlake. I like Justin Timberlake. I think he's very funny and he's clearly musically talented. There's a little bit of a referendum on Justin Timberlake going on right now, vis-a-vis looking back at his interactions with Janet Jackson, Britney Spears. All that aside, because I know you don't pay attention to any of that kind of discourse. What did you think of JT's performance in this movie?
I really like him. In basically everything I've seen him in.
Okay.
I saw him in this. I saw him in, what is it called? In Time or something, that sci-fi thing where you add time to your life. I don't think I've seen a performance of his that I disliked.
I thought he was shaky in this on retrospect, like, and kind of unconvincing.
Really?
He's no. OK, he's really good at playing Sean Parker, the BS artist, the Silicon Valley corporate raider. He's not very good at playing the other kind of like awkward emotional stuff, vulnerable stuff. Maybe that's because like it's easier for him to tap into being confident and young and cocky and rich. And like, that's essentially he's playing a fictionalized version of himself. But like when it came time to like, oh, God, I'm in the room and I've ruined these guys' friendships. And how do I feel about that? Like there was nothing there. But okay. I don't know how much of that is like me also being kind of like plugged into how people are thinking about him, discussing. And so you think
95% of what he's asked to do in this movie is the Justin Timberlake that just knocks it out of the park, knocks it out of the
Shonathon.
Yeah.
The Shonathon stuff I thought was, yeah, he excelled at.
Oh,
yeah.
He's fantastic at it. And that's the bulk of what he's got to do. So I guess I didn't notice the other parts, but you might be right. Now that I'm thinking about it,
I want to talk about the Shonathon, because I think that's also a very interesting core that I didn't see a lot of people talking about. The rot that's in Silicon Valley, this disease of more, you know, it's like, you know, what's cooler than $1 million, $1 billion? And this guy like saying like what Eduardo was doing, he's like, oh, yeah, that might work, but you might as well have founded a successful chain of yogurt stands. And like, is that bad? And the one kind of like parable he told about the person who invented Victoria's Secrets and, you know, parlayed it to 3 or 4 stores, sold it for $4 million, and then killed himself 3 years later when it was worth $500 billion. Well, that's crazy.
Yeah.
This man had secured his financial future and his entire family's financial future and could have gone out and done whatever the fuck he wanted to, but he killed himself because what could he have done with $4 million that he couldn't done with $500 million, except for, I guess, not throw himself off the Golden Gate fucking bridge? Like, yeah. This is the craziness, right?
And we're that, caught. That is, 10 years later, we're at a point where you can't even utter the line, you know, $1 million is not cool. What's cool is $1 billion. Because that's a joke at this point. It's a literal joke in Silicon Valley. Right. The show, the Three Comma Club, is something that is joked about.
Right.
We're at the point where you have to say $1 billion isn't cool. You know what's cool? $1 trillion. Like,
yep.
That's where we're at. It is a disease of more.
There's an active race amongst like 20 or 30 people on this planet to be the first capital T trillionaire. Absolutely. Then they have to be talking about it behind the scenes. There's no fucking way these people are not talking about who's going to be the first.
It's already happened, hasn't it?
No, we don't have a trillionaire yet.
One point something trillion.
Well, but no one person in this planet is worth $1 trillion.
I guess
you got companies value, but not a single person can grab their can write that many. You don't the four what would that be? Gotcha. The Four Comma Club.
Sure. Yeah.
Still has no membership. But like I just thought there was something interesting about that. And yeah, he's got
not being
like
happy
some
with success, having to have more success than everybody else.
But some of the ways he looked at things, like Eduardo tries to like put the brakes on the crazy train at this Seanathon meeting. Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah, I broke the record labels and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, yeah, but wait, you lost all those lawsuits. They won. And his reply of like, oh, well, if you think they won, go try to, are you interested in buying a Tower Records right now?
No, but I'm interested in getting it on the ground floor of Spotify. I'm interested in the iTunes Music Store. I'm interested in buying a fucking record label, which is more profitable than it's ever been. Like,
I know
that's the thing about this line.
The idea that record labels were on the ropes 10 years ago and Sean Parker put him there is such a joke at this point.
Yeah.
Because they just, it's like
it was a speeding ticket for them, is what it was.
Exactly. Thank you for, we didn't know how to navigate this interesting digital divide. You showed us the way, Sean. You showed us that people will, and like if the people have this enormous appetite for digital music and they don't give a shit that they don't have physical things. And for a dollar, they'll pay the same amount
that they did for an album.
Have to physically ship anything. Right. Thank you so much, Sean. Thank you so much. And people will cheer us for all the decisions. Oh, thank you, Apple, for giving us the high quality versions of stuff.
Right.
And for it's insane. And then, but like they did a really good job of showing how Zuckerberg was just enraptured by this guy, hook, line, and sinker. On the one hand, he had a buddy that's saying, hey, we got to do the hard stuff. We got to build a business model. We got to.
Yeah.
Earn advertising. We got to start paying these bills, man. And the other hand, you had a guy that just breezes in. It's like, hey, what do you got now? You got a party and what are you going to do? Tell people it's over at 11 o'clock. Now you just got to keep growing. Who gives a shit about anything else? It'll all be figured out. And oh, drop the V off the Facebook. And it's almost a parody at this point to see Eisenberg like play that. Holy shit. Like, oh my God, he's blew my mind. We got, the Facebook. Yeah. But JT was really good at that. But it also just again, and there, at the end where he's like, snorting drugs off a 15-year-old's belly or whatever the fuck it is. And he's like just raving, just almost lunatic stuff. Like, we used to live on farms, man. And then we lived on cities and now we're going to live on the internet. It's like, well, yeah, but like, first of all, that's some pretty shallow historical analysis. And B, it starts at us living on farms. And like, what is the broad historical analysis of like us being better off in one living environment or another? He doesn't give a shit.
Sure. Yeah.
He's just trying to, profit on where the next piece of real estate is going to be.
Fascinating
stuff.
I don't want it to sound like I'm shitting on this too much because I subscribe to a lot actually of the ideas that are being portrayed or put forward here, like not necessarily the part about it being cool, like, oh, it's $1 million is not cool, $1 billion is. I don't give a shit about that, but like the idea of growing something without trying to monetize it at the beginning makes a lot of sense to me, because as somebody who hates advertising pretty much across the board, as somebody who wants to engage with something that is clean, that does exactly what it says it's going to do, that's kind of the era of Facebook you were looking at there, right? And saying, okay, well, you don't want to muck this up with a whole bunch of bullshit to try and find some small ball advertising revenue. You need to let this thing grow organically, and then you can figure out what to do with it once you know what it is. I think that's all great.
That is certainly something that definitely influenced us too. Like, when we're in any kind of phase of rapid growth, like don't worry over much about monetizing it, like make it, cause you don't want to, it's better to grow than to monetize. Now, if you stop growing, then you just start looking at ways to maximize monetization. But yeah, like that was a pretty incredible insight that like, until you know what you've got, and if you're having a hard time, would you rather sell a couple of ads for a yogurt stand, or would you rather just and turn people off like, oh, God, what is all these yogurt ads all over my experience? Or would you rather just grow unfettered until you get something that's so big? So, I mean, that's the thing about Facebook. They were celebrating their 500 millionth user in like, I don't know, 52 countries at the end of this movie. I looked it up. How many users do you think Facebook has globally in 2021?
My guess is 2 billion.
2.8 billion. Roughly one out of every three people sucking oxygen, closer to one and out of two on this planet, is a Facebook user. And quite literally, the value of that is incalculable.
Yeah.
Like, there's a number on a stock market and all that kind of stuff, but what that is worth and the power that it's that provides, that's why there's the congressional hearings, right? Because this is arguably a nation state larger than anything that's ever been constructed before in the world, and it's all in private hands. It's pretty amazing.
But that's why people get so fired up, right? It's ideas like that. It's and everybody who sees this movie, I think in 2010, comes out of it thinking, man, I want to go do that. I want to go do something, right? It's not necessarily I want to make Facebook, but I want to make something happen.
Agreed. Yeah.
Because that part of it is the inspirational part. It's the part where you're being an asshole and backstabbing your friends and potentially ruining democracy that is not quite as inspirational.
What do you think of Eduardo freezing the accounts as in terms of plays go?
Eduardo loses me a couple of times during this movie. That's one of them. But what do you do? Like, he's on a train that's out of control, right? There is no brake on this train. Mark Zuckerberg is just fueling. He's like Back to the Future 3. He's putting in the red log, right? And he's going to take this thing right over the edge. Eduardo doesn't know what to do. I think like he's at the end of his rope and this is the only thing he can think to do. So I get it, but also I think it was dumb.
It's like, it's one of those, like, I was just trying to get your attention. It makes sense because the one thing you can do is show you still do need me, you son of a bitch. Yeah. Sean Parker might be getting you meetings, but I'm the one that's getting you paid. I'm the one that's paying the bills on this. I'm the one that's paying the bandwidth on the server and I can fuck you. Just the way you're fucking me. I'm not sure what the best way to make that play. Again, keeping in mind, all these guys are in the early 20s. This is some like fucking weird. Like, I always love to remember the fact that like these guys who architected this modern society were extraordinarily young. And it reminds me, I guess it's kind of like analogous to the American Revolution, because that's the other thing is like, we think of these founding fathers as the old dude and the powdered wigs on our money, but they were all in their like mid-20s, the early 30s, doing for the majority of them. There's a couple old guys, but most of them were just like these young dudes, man. Mm-hmm. Like, they didn't know what the fuck they were doing. Neither did these guys. But like, we give all of this, like 250 plus years on to the experience, we give all of this importance and this veneer of correctness because I think the same thing's happening to the Silicon Valley dudes, because it's like, well, they did this and they were smart and who are we to question them? Because look at the success, you know, speaks for itself.
Yeah, I do get the impression that at any time had Eduardo actually backed out of this thing and said, well, the funding is cut off, how are you going to pay for your servers? I mean, when you're at however many millions of users or whatever that Facebook had at that point, you go to what, to your parents and say, hey, mom, dad, look, I got this fucking thing here and it's huge. I need 20 grand to keep it going. And they write that check immediately, right?
That's the thing. Does Mark Zuckerberg have I didn't know if his parents actually came from wealth. I should have looked that up because that's like one of my favorite things to do.
Yeah.
Is look at who their parents are.
I guess if they legit don't have 20 grand, but then you take out a loan. I don't know. Like, any bank looks at this.
Okay, so he's got his mother's a psychiatrist who practiced in New York City, and his father's a dentist.
Sure,
I'm not saying Zuckerberg. He's not Winkle. He's not Winklevoss rich, but he's like, yeah, they can probably fund you for a month or two. I think that's the thing. Like, once he moved to California, and had it into a startup and got to like six figures in users, there's the time to flex and be like, hey, no, we're in the same business. But on the other hand, I also like the movie kind of paints. It does this switcheroo, because they show Eduardo is like, oh, I'm going to stay here on my, internship and with my girlfriend because I don't really believe in Facebook. But then later on, you know, when he gets out there, he asserts, I quit my internship on day one and I kind of like want to leave my girlfriend. I want to come out here. And I flash back to what I know about Zuckerberg and how he dealt with the Winklevoss twins, where he's basically saying, yeah, yeah, no, everything's cool. Yeah, no. And until he thought he was solidified and secure and then he plunged the knife. I felt like, I don't know if I take that understanding from that part of the movie into this one, then, you know, Eduardo probably got fucked, because it's like, it's one thing if the guy's like, yeah, like that would suck if he's like, you know, I don't believe in Facebook. I'm going to pursue, because I'm going to pursue my internship or my girlfriend here, because I think that's my life here. And then Mark Zuckerberg went on for a couple of years and did his own thing, made it big. And this guy shows up like some kind of absentee father and says, oh, I always believed you. Where's my 30%? I don't know how I feel about Mark Zuckerberg moving across the country away from this guy and then trying to desperately sever all of his ties to that guy. If that guy was wanting to come out there and help, I don't know. I don't feel like I got the whole story on that.
For sure. The movie is very vague on those details. And I don't know if that's intentional or he just didn't feel comfortable writing those scenes because there is no information, but I don't know. I mean, he talked to guys like Eduardo, right? In the creation of this script. So he's got bits and pieces, but it's all, you know, there are three POVs here. And whose do you value? Whose do you give weight to at any given point in the movie? And it does a pretty good job of balancing those.
I think so. And there's enough breadcrumbs that if you really want to know the answer, you can probably go find it. Before we wrap things up, I want to take one more brief break and we'll be right back. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
There's a couple, we talk about the conclusion of this movie, because there's a couple things I think the movie has conclusion. And I remember, man, there was so many people being mad about the portrayal of nerd culture. And like how they made it out to be misogynist and all that stuff. This was back in the 2010s when the movie first came out. Stuff that, like, I think we've got enough history at this point to be like, no, Silicon Valley culture, nerd culture, actively hostile to women.
Oh, yeah.
You know, doesn't make them feel safe or included. There's this great scene where Zuckerberg is like divvying out all these assignments to people and like their girlfriends who they've established are smart and bright. And from well-funded families say, well, what can we do? And they're like, oh, nothing. Can't even imagine. No selling ads, no publicity, no art, not just kind of sit over there and look pretty. It does feel like that. I don't know what to make of that early, like 2010s, like pushback against like this nerd misogyny. Like but man, there's so much blood and ink spilt, like just in the Gamergate stuff and just, you know, how many sexual assault and harassment lawsuits that have come out of Silicon Valley, out of the boardrooms. It seems like it's one of those things that like was pretty cut and dry. And it feels like this movie is rife for a sequel. Yeah. In fact,
yeah.
And you pointed out that the problem with it is that the movie, the sequel to this film is not over. Like,
right.
But I do feel like there is enough that like, I don't know. I think it would be fascinating to do a trilogy of these. Mm-hmm. Where you had The Social Network, then you have part two, which is kind of like the meteoric rise of Facebook. And now instead of like the lawsuits and the personal costs that it costs Zuckerberg, now it's him in front of Congress. Now it's him answering for questions about coups in the Middle East. And now it's like him answering questions about election interference and advertising from Russian assets and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And just the same way that, like, I don't know, The Social Network didn't have a real convincing ending. It just ended and then had some title cards based on how the lawsuits, like,
yeah.
And then like maybe 10 years in the future, we could have a Citizen Kane like final, like, OK, because like clearly. It seems like the U.S. government, and they're already well under the way doing this in Europe and in Australia. There's this desire to like, OK, this is, we don't know what the hell to do with this thing, but what we're concerned with is it's too big. It's got to be broken up. Like, I think you could easily make a third film just on whatever is going to happen in the next 10 years as far as antitrust and breaking things up and us finding more and more investigations about this. What do you think of that? Is there an appetite for this kind of stuff?
Yeah, I have an appetite for it. I'd love to see Sorkin take a crack at the, you know, part two of this. And I don't think it's an ending either. But like you said, it could be a milestone movie where, yeah, we just look at all that. I think everybody's in on it too. Like I've seen Jesse Eisenberg talk about, like I would play, you know, Zuckerberg again. Sorkin's in just as long as Fincher is directing. So
I saw the same.
He's kind of the guy that, you know, you need to put a little pressure on if you want this to happen.
Yeah, I wonder how they would, because I think some of the things, the personal criticism they leveled at Zuckerberg are not entirely accurate in this movie, but a lot of them that they didn't really get into were very accurate. And it's be interesting to see how, since they built this on a fictionalized portrayal, like how did they eventually get that? Maybe they don't. It's like, you know, well, if they made a movie now, Mark Zuckerberg is in his mid to going on late 30s. He's been married for a long time to one woman. There hasn't been a lot of like accusations of personal misogyny against him the way there are some of these other like billionaire tech boys. I think it would be a lot more about like, well, with the first movie is a story about how he screwed over his friends. This is going to be how he screwed over society itself.
Yeah.
How he broke the social contract, you know?
Yeah,
maybe that's what it's, the social network, the social contract. Mm-hmm. And then I don't know what the fucking third movie would be. And yeah, seems to be kind of unapologetic about it, too.
Yeah, completely from what I've read.
But I don't know, like also how to, because like, what do we expect Zuckerberg to do? Get testify in Congress and just like just completely shit to bed and say, yeah, it's all my fault. I knowingly subverted democracy. I took dark money funneled from Russian assets. I mean, there's like legal consequences to that testimony. Like, even if it's the truth, what do we expect from it?
Right. I don't expect him to get in front of Congress and say that. I do expect the behavior to change behind the scenes. And everything I've read about behind the scenes is he's like, nah, fuck everybody. I'm building the biggest thing on the planet and I don't care about the consequences.
Yeah, explicitly saying what the consequences are, how they can avoid the consequences. But like the idea that, I don't know. And they've also like, you know, Facebook for the last 10 years had a pretty good like messaging team where they're just like, hey, man, we're just trying to connect people. Wouldn't it be amazing if everybody in the world was connected? What if we all connect? But like behind the scenes, they did that. They didn't have some kind of altruistic goal of like networking every human in Earth. It was all about like making this the biggest and best and how it can make them money, how it can make them power. I do hope these, and it seems like, yeah, all the principals agree that they want to do it, that it should be done. All they need to find is like a nice pause point and I think we're there. Like
we are
yeah. like at this inflection point where you could plausibly end a second movie with like a bunch of questions. Like
I say that, but something could happen tomorrow that's just like, oh shit, like they can't end the movie here. You know?
Right. But like, I don't know, you could say something like Facebook has 2/5 of the world's population, more than that. I can't think. Yeah, that's more than, yeah, like 2/5 of the world's population, and it's valued at whatever $1 trillion, you know, like you could do that and just then leave it open for, because who knows what the fucking governments are going to do?
Yeah.
You know, who knows, like the, you know, like this thing in Australia, the way I understand it is it's essentially a scuffle over whether Facebook can essentially take people's traffic and just steal it, you know, like the new, like in like this trading of news links and stuff. Like that used to be, go to the Australian Times or whatever's webpage and they'd sell ads on that. Well, now you can just read the whole fucking thing on Facebook. And oh, by the way, people don't even read past the headlines anymore anyway. So like it's literally destroys, and they want to get paid. It's not like we want Facebook to stop sharing our shit. We just want to get a dime for every time they link it or something.
Yeah.
It's very unclear to me, you know, like I remember being excited in the 90s about the prospect of, you know, I was a big Linux guy, free software guy. I was very excited about the prospect of Microsoft getting split up the way they did, you know, AT&T and Ma Bell. Now I see that that didn't do anything but spawn a whole bunch of profitable vertical enterprises for Microsoft. And also, all, by the way, AT&T, whoo, really, really took that behemoth down. Really right. regulated them into humility and a good corporate governance and customer support. Woo, showed them a thing or two. Like, I'm very cynical about all of this stuff. I really don't know what the fuck is going to happen in the next 10, 20 years.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of these companies, you know, are poised to become even more a part of our lives. Like I look at, you know, stuff that's happening with VR is not like getting a ton of traction, but as we go more and more online and fewer of our interactions happen offline, there becomes this big incentive for people to find genuine interactions online, right? Not like, oh, I'm doom scrolling my Twitter feed looking for the people I follow to say witty things. It's like, where can I have a conversation with somebody genuinely online? Facebook is poised to become that, you know, pivot back into like real human interactions, just in the virtual space. You know, we could be looking at the next I forget the name of it, the next Mao enterprises in space, right? From like 20 years from now, who knows where Facebook could go. It's like trying to predict a milestone here is kind of crazy, and I feel like it'll look really silly in the future.
Yeah, what was that, Mao Kwiatkowski Mercantile, the $1 trillion thing in The Expanse?
Yeah, go to space, go to VR, go to wherever. Like, there are new real estate is being developed, and it's in cyberspace.
Yeah, and also there's increasingly physical things, like, you know, Elon Musk diversifying into space flight and self-driving cars, and Amazon is doing, like, you know, trying to do drone delivery and last mile service. Like, there's all this crazy innovation happening. Where does all that fit in? You know, like, I remember all of the hand-wringing about Walmart and what that's going to do to small town America and all that, but like now it's like Amazon looks like it's the beast. It's like it's the final objective. It's the final state of the world. It's like everybody will work in an Amazon fulfillment center. They'll shop on Amazon.com.
Well, but they won't, like, because when the drones are delivering shit and the robots are picking it from the shelves, nobody will work anywhere. That's
true.
That's the problem.
What do we do about that? Mm-hmm.
Good luck solving that problem. Maybe I'll die especially before that happens. That'll be great.
Especially when the people who are going to inform us about it, like, guess what? All their infrastructure runs on Amazon. Mm-hmm. Cloud computing and what happens?
Oh, you tried to form a union to stop this? Well, we're going to run ads on our own platforms that may or may not get taken down.
The union busting that Amazon is doing right now would be the envy of any street tough in the 1910s. You know,
nightstick, right?
Yeah, they don't need to run up on people protesting and beat them to death with baseball bats. They can just like nip all that in the bud with their captive audiences and with their captive politicians. And
Yeah.
I don't know.
Convincing the public that it's a bad idea somehow.
Right. Well, I mean, like, look at what the, you know, like, they're, it's so funny because, like, the Uber legislation that went down in California, that they, what, they spend, like, $400 million?
Trying to oppose that?
Is that what the number? Trying to, and got it done. And, like, there was, like, people saying, like, there are, well, there's easy predict and bad consequences from passing this legislation. And the second that they are successful, it's going to happen all across the world. You're going to see this happen in New York. You're going to see this happen in Texas. And they were, all the naysayers are right, because that's exactly what's going to happen. You know, I don't know. It seems crazy, because, like, my industry did that. They fought this, like, you know, in programming, there was this, like, hey, you know what? Why are we paying people salary and benefits when we can just, you know, give them a 1099 and pay them a flat rate? They can pay their own damn taxes. Like, this is super easy to get. And the IRS is like, well, you know, you can't just say that you're not treating a full-time employee like a full-time employee and get away with it. Yeah. Like, I feel like that's in the next 5 years coming down the pike, that, like, there's some kind of Supreme Court ruling that'll be like, you can't fucking legislate a full-time job away just because you really, really want it to, you know? I don't know.
We'll see. I mean, there are a lot of these fights coming up in the very near future, and Facebook is going to be a part of a lot of them.
That's true. And they're going to be where people get the majority of their news, especially like large voting blocks, like baby boomers and whatnot.
That's why I downloaded the AP's app instead of using Facebook for
getting
my news.
Unvarnished, eh?
Yeah, I gotta get it from the source, man.
Yeah, I saw that. That's another thing that's encouraging. I'm seeing a lot of renewed interest in, like, public television and reporting. Like, people, like, that's always been the fear in this country. It's like, oh God, right. Well, if the government's providing funding for the news, well, then of course it'll just be a tool of the state. And yet a lot of people are looking at, like, you know, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and the British Broadcasting Corporation, and, like, the quality of news that this guy, it doesn't always work. There was some questionable takes in British media about Brexit, for example. They're having some issues with transphobia in the news. But it's hard to look at what's going on here in America in the last 30 years on AM radio, on a cable news network, on our internet, and think that, oh yeah, privately funded media, that's the way, that's the silver bullet solution for this.
Yeah.
But there is a renewed interest in public broadcasting and public journalism, which I think is encouraging, because if nothing else, it's something that can compete with the paid for journalism. And that's the other frustrating thing is, I've seen so many news, seen so many articles, think pieces about this. It's kind of like making the observation that, like, you have to pay for the truth, high quality journalism. You know, it's not free. You can't go to Wall Street Journal and, you know, New York Times. They hit you with paywalls. The places just making shit up, that stuff is free, man. It's got, you know, you just subscribe to it on YouTube. Yeah, you get it. It's pumped out on the airwaves. It's pumped out on all the free television stuff. Like, it's, how do you compete with that?
I mean, it's exactly the same model as they're talking about with Facebook, right? Like, grow this thing until you know what it is. Getting your product in the hands of more people is more important than monetizing it today. And
yeah,
that's how these quote unquote news corporations work. They just get eyeballs on their stuff.
One last thing. I saw this. This was one of the last things I read before we convened for the podcast. But there's this interesting article that was essentially stating that what Fincher and Sorkin were doing here. This is essentially the baby boomer generation, like, reporting on or passing judgment on the millennial generation.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that? Is there any truth to that? That, like, some of this is, like, a lot of tut-tutting and, you know, being concerned because, oh, the youth today, what are they doing? We built this democracy and it's great. And we had protests and we ended the Vietnam War. And what are you guys fucking doing with it now?
Does the movie do a lot of that? Because I don't get the sense coming out of this movie that the movie has a strong opinion about the thing that is Facebook. It has more of an opinion, or it doesn't even have a super strong opinion about the people involved in this. It's more like, we're just presenting to you a compelling story of these three different tales of what happened here, and it's up to you to sort of place your sympathies and you know, understand it. But, like, on Facebook, the core thing, I'm not sure the movie has much of an opinion.
Damn. Yeah, I think you're right. Like, I think you are right. Like, if they came back and did it now, it would be. But like,
yeah,
if they're expressing like the judgiest they are of this movie or of this culture is when they're kind of like making commentary but not commentating about the, you know, way they use women, the way they use drugs and alcohol
stuff. Yeah.
Not just that, but like just the culture of like, you know, drunken coding marathons and the partying and the drugs and all that kind of stuff. But like, Jesus Christ, I've seen the movie Wall Street. Like, I know that they knew what was going on in the late 70s and the early 80s. Like, I don't know that like it, as a critique, a generational critique is going to stick, you know, because like, how is that different than what we saw the Wolf of Wall Street? And, you know, at least these guys built something legitimate and they're not just getting rich on penny stocks and manipulation and stuff. So,
right.
Yeah. They're manipulating our need for a community and the fact that we don't have any. It's interesting because especially since, like, you know, a lot of people rightfully so are lauding this age we're going into, like where people can work from home and telecommute again. I know I'm leaving out a lot of service jobs and factory jobs and stuff, but like white collar jobs are just like, woohoo, we can be decentralized. We don't have to go. But like, I keep thinking that as like, man, that's the last social fabric for a lot of Americans.
Yeah.
Don't go to church anymore. We don't have social clubs. There's no town square to congregate around. Now there's not a water cooler.
Mm-hmm.
There's no place where you can be forced to hang out with people you don't 100% agree with. You can't self-select your own bubble of people. I am a little bit afraid of like what that's going to do to, you know, people, especially people living in the cities where, you know, it's like you're surrounded by people, but so crushingly alone.
And it's isolating because I think you're always going to disagree with somebody on something. And if you go around, you know, blocking or unfriending everybody who you disagree with on anything, you're going to be left with no friends. And you're not, like you said, you're not going to be forced to interact regularly with people you don't agree 100% with. So it has a very isolating effect too. It's not just that, you know, you're self-selecting your group. You may not even have a group by the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I hope that there is a sequel and that Sorkin and Fincher get together to do it. Eisenberg, I guess. I wonder if how do you think Eisenberg would portray like modern era Zuck, like Brent Spiner as Data Zuckerberg. Zuckerberg mechanically drinking water and not blinking in Congress, because like there is a little bit of charisma, because I do think Jesse has this kind of weird, you know, charisma to his performance.
For sure.
And just the raw, like, do you, how will they do that in the second film? Like, will that be seen as like a facade that he's putting up, or will he just like, oh, that's Zuck. He's mellowed into an android. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. I assume he'd play him pretty much like this, except maybe somehow more entitled. Yeah, I'm not sure.
You bring back Rashida Jones and she's trying to patiently explain to him, like, these aren't the Winklevosses. This isn't your buddy that you fucked over beers in Harvard. These are senators and congresspeople. And he's like, well, if they're that important, then why don't they have a YouTube account or something? I can see the
he's probably the only guy that they absolutely need to bring back. Right. Everybody else in this movie, I feel like, is dealt with. If you're going to do a sequel,
there's no reason.
You just need Jesse Eisenberg and you recast everybody else. So, or not but you just cast new cast characters.
I would love to see a Winklevoss movie about their Bitcoin billions. Like
Mesrick has written a book about Bitcoin. I don't know if it's about them, but yeah,
I saw that. They have to be. I mean, they're prominent people in this whole sword play. So they'd have to be. But no, I think there'd be a real. There's got to be some real fun information to mine about these fucking idiots.
Yeah.
that, you know, keep somehow failing upwards in life. I don't know. Maybe they're nice guys. Maybe they're, you know, they're
clearly hard workers. You don't make it to the Olympics with you don't fail up into the Olympics.
Yeah. But you don't come in sixth in the Beijing Olympics by being out of only 20 countries that sent athletes to compete in this particular event. Yeah, no.
Anybody who makes it to the Olympics, I'm not going to talk shit about. They were dedicated. I don't care.
They're dedicated on furiously pulling a stick for 6 years. Yes. And that dedication pulled off or paid off. So what are you going to do? But I wouldn't mind seeing a Winklevi movie. I got to see the social network, the social consequences, we'll call it. Do you have anything else you want to talk about with the Social Network?
No, I think I'm good.
Well, I hope you guys enjoyed our discussion of the movie and kind of like the questions it raises and how we feel about it 10 years on. We'll be back next week with another great one. It's First Blood that started the Rambo trilogy. And if you're only familiar with Rambo, based on his image of roided up, oiled up,
the headband, you know, and the
Sylvester Stallone
automatic
stripped
weapon,
to the waist with a big, you know, squad assault weapon, just mowing down hundreds of Ruskies, then you might be in for a surprise, because First Blood is a good film. It's actually a really good film, and I'm looking forward to watching it. But we'll be back with First Blood, the original 1982 origin story of Rambo, next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.